Good morning. Glad to see each of you. Glad to have you here with us. We're continuing our study in the book of Revelation, and today we're going to get into lesson 18, which covers chapter 17. And we're going to talk about the Scarlet Woman and the Scarlet Beast. And as I mentioned earlier, this is, in my opinion, probably the hardest section of the book, especially as we get to the heads and the horns of the beast here in a second. And that will become evident as we get into it. And then also, none of the commentators exactly agree as to what it means, although there is some similarity, and we'll talk about that here in a minute. All right, so just as a reminder, we finished up the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and then the seven bowls of wrath. We've looked at the complete and final destruction. And now what we're doing is we're, I think, taking a step back and we're kind of zooming in on this last little bit of the seven bowls of wrath, looking at it in more detail. And then the question is why? Why are we going into this level of detail? And I think a interesting characteristic that we see about God comes out when we go back and look at past destructions of nations that God has wrought. So in Ezekiel, as he's preparing to destroy Jerusalem and then Judah and then send them off into Babylonian captivity, he has this conversation with Ezekiel. He says, "Son of man, do you see what they are doing, the great abominations that the house of Israel commits here to make me go far away from my sanctuary? Now, turn again, you will see greater abominations." Again, this is very figurative, very symbolic, because he has Ezekiel dig through the wall, all right? So he's going deeper and deeper into people's houses and into the temple and seeing the abominations that people are doing. They're working it privately, thinking that God doesn't see, and God is showing this to Ezekiel. And what's the purpose? He's constantly saying, do you see? Go in, turn in, see. Keep going deeper and deeper. And the whole point is that he's going to bring destruction, that when it happens, even though Ezekiel has seen all of these things, he reacts emotionally and he says, Lord God, will you destroy all the remnant of Israel and pouring out your fury on Jerusalem? And then God explains, this is because of what they have done. They're the excess of their bloodshed, their perversity, the fact that they think that I've forsaken the land, and they'll get their wish. I will forsake them. I will turn them over to Babylon. I will recompense their deeds upon them. So one of the interesting things that I think we see in Ezekiel, and I think we're seeing it also in Revelation, is that God wants us to understand his judgments. They're not arbitrary. He is not just saying, oh, time's up. You've had your turn. Now it's time for another nation. There is a reason for his judgment, and it's driven by his sense of justice, his characteristic. And so why does God care what we think? He does. He wants us to see him as just. So as Romans 3, 4, 25, and 26 talk about that he may overcome when he is judged. He recognizes that we have doubts, that we may have accusations, that other beings may have accusations against him. And he wants to make sure that it's abundantly clear that he is just whenever people throw him into this judgment. So the judgment that God showed Ezekiel in chapters 8 and 9 was there to explain, at least partially, the reason for its severity. And I think that's the same thing that we're also getting here. There's other reasons, but for people who are far removed from the crimes of Rome, it may seem strange that there was such wanton destruction that was brought upon them. And so for people like that are so far removed, they will need extra explanation to understand why this nation, why it's falling. All right. So with that kind of intro in mind, let's get into chapter 17 and look at the description of the woman and the beast. All right. What is the scope of this harlot's influence? How many people is she affecting?
First one says she sits on many waters.
All right. So we're told that she sits on many waters. So then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you the judgment. Keep that in mind. He's showing us, just like in Ezekiel, he's showing us the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So she's affecting all classes, even as far as kings, inhabitants of the earth. It's very broad, but again, the earth has special significance to us. This represents the realm, if you will, of the lost, of the unregenerate. And so this is emphasizing those who are bound to false religion that she is specifically having sway over. So these are the people that have been brought into her trance. We're going to talk more about many waters. We've looked at it briefly before. We're going to look at it again here in a few verses, but just suffice it to say for now that what Joshua said is correct. This represents many different kinds of peoples, many different kinds of nations, and we're going to see that in verse 15 where that's spelled out for us. All right, now, she's in this position of great influence, great control. How is she doing this? What power is given to her to allow her to have this sway over other people? What can you gather from her description?
She's
draws men with her immorality and tempts them with their own lust.
All right, very good. So two things that are brought out. First of all, she's a harlot. So all the powers attributed to a harlot, to a seductress, are conveyed to her as well. She will have such powers and such temptations as well. But the other thing that's brought out is she's got in her hand this cup of the that will lead to drunkenness. So she's holding out intoxicants as well that she's luring people in with. Something that this golden cup, it looks wonderful. It looks like it would be fun. It looks appealing. But we're going to find out that it has terrible consequences. So notice, the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So this reminds us, I wish we had time to go back and read Proverbs 5 and Proverbs 7, dealing with the strange woman or the immoral woman or the seductress, and Solomon's warning to his sons to avoid these women that would pull her in. And he mentions that her house leads to hell, and that those that are cast down include the strong. All right, and we see the strong, if you will, also being cast down here as well. It's the kings of the earth that have been deceived by her, all the inhabitants of the earth. So she's very seductive, convincing even strong people to give in to her. So what does she represent? Again, this idea of everything that's sensual, lustful, alluring, appealing to sin. So John warns us in 1 John 2:15 through 17 not to have the love of the world or the things that are passing away, like the pride of life and what appeals to the flesh and what appeals to the eye. So she has that same kind of power, that same kind of pull. And certainly with what we know from Rome, that would have been very fitting given their luxury and their decadence and all that was associated with them. Also, as we mentioned, it reminds us of everything we think about in Proverbs as well as in Habakkuk 2 about the power of intoxicating drugs, how they look good, they seem good, they make you feel good at first, but then they have terrible consequences in the end. In Habakkuk 2, 5, and 15, it specifically mentions that Babylon uses this, ancient original Babylon, uses this to put its neighbors, neighboring countries, if you will, into positions where they are compromised, where it is easy for them to take advantage of them. And so a similar kind of symbol and effect is being used here as well, as one nation is bringing in these other nations and kingdoms. All right, so the idea of this cup and being drunken, not with wine, but with something else, this is used throughout the scriptures, especially in the Old Testament and the major prophets, and it has a dual meaning. Again, the part of the idea is kind of obvious, that here is something that looks good, but in the end, it bites like a serpent. It brings destruction. But it's also used of nations that are being forced to drink this cup. Those that have said, yes, I want to partake of that. It looks good. And then God using that and saying, okay, you've got to drink it all the way down to the dregs. The very last bit of the drink, you're going to consume it all. And in these cases, it refers to relations that they started with other nations that were wicked. And as they made relations with them, and then those nations that ultimately turned on them and then ultimately destroyed them. So it often references the destruction that God is bringing in on sinful nations, as well as using other nations to accomplish this as well. So we've already seen this in chapter 14:8 and 16:19, where this is part of the cause for Rome's destruction. They're called out to be Babylon. But in Psalm 75 and then Isaiah 51, you also see this idea of having to drink this cup that God has provided, drinking it all the way down to the dregs and being destroyed as a consequence of that. All right. So a very rich symbol that's worth a lot of other study. Similar symbols used in Jeremiah 51, specifically of Babylon being the golden cup in the Lord's hand that he uses to actually mete out destruction through the original ancient Babylon on these other nations. So a lot of rich heritage in this symbol. All right, questions, comments? All right, so we talked about this. Upon whom or what does the harlot sit? How does this entity relate to previously described characters? We're not talking about the waters here. We're talking about something else.
She sits on a scarlet beast, which seems almost exactly like the sea beast.
All right. Yeah, it matches the sea beast exactly, except for the one thing that he's called scarlet. Other than that, it's exactly like that. So he carried me away into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. With the exception of the scarlet, that is identical to what we see in chapter 13 with the beast that rises up out of the sea. Just a few notes where he says, they carried me away in the spirit. We've seen this a few times. Again, really impressing upon us the fact that this is a vision. This is something that is to be taken figuratively, symbolically. This is not literal. And we looked at this phrase and how it's used at the beginning of this study, but I just want to reference it again. The idea of going into the wilderness, We talked about, remember, the radiant woman who stands as a contrast to this one, how she went into the wilderness. One of the other things that it reminds me of that I didn't mention before is you remember where John went and did his preaching? He went into the wilderness. And then all of Judea and Jerusalem was going out to him. The wilderness is used a lot of different ways throughout Scripture, but I think this one may be more of the idea, especially when you put chapter 12 with this chapter 17. In all these cases, you have someone who's kind of removed from society, if you will, who's trying to pull society out to them. So whether it's John the Baptist preaching in the wilderness, or whether it's the radiant woman representing God's people, the church, the institution going out, also having a call of its own, or if it's this harlot who is trying to seduce the world as well. So it could be a reference to that. And then also Jesus in Matthew 4, that's where he was carried out to be tempted as well. So the idea of like drawing out, inviting to come out, appealing to come out, and having temptation associated with that could be the idea of the wilderness here. Caleb?
I was going to ask, the possible difference be that the ten horns here do not have the diadems, or in chapter 13 they had the diadems, but we'll see later that the ten horns will eventually receive authority. Possible difference?
Could be. There's definitely parts of the beast description that are left out from chapter 13. Having not thought about that, I would just kind of say, well, maybe that's just something he's not focusing on. But to be honest, I'd have to think about it some more. So that's a good question and a good possibility. Other thoughts or comments? All right. So we talked about it being identical to what we see in chapter 13, where we see the beast rising out of the sea, having the seven heads and ten horns. And as Caleb mentioned, the ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. So we see the sea beast supporting, upholding, carrying the great harlot. So what does this mean to us? All right, so to answer this question, let's look at the name that's assigned to the harlot. And how does this compare to other harlots that we see depicted for us in Old Testament prophecy? So first, the easy part. What name is given to her?
Babylon the Great.
Babylon the Great. Mystery, right? So is it, in the idea of being mystery, could it be that it's not obvious who she is, that he is in fact revealing who she really is, or that it's shrouded possibly in mystery? Both of those are good ideas. I like the idea that, again, she, as mysteries are always uncovered or revealed, she appears seductive, she appears appealing, but we're going to see her true nature revealed for us. So that could also be the connection. All right, how does this one compare to other harlots we've seen in the past in Old Testament prophecy?
It's similar to the other nations that are referred to in Old Testament prophecies. There are great nations that have a lot of influence, but they end up using it to spread immorality and make bad connections with other nations. Right. You used to refer to like Tyre or Jerusalem, places like that.
All right, very good. So this is actually, and this is something that's often overlooked by a lot of people. This is not a unique symbol. It's applied many times throughout Old Testament prophecy to other nations. So she's arrayed in purple, scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So a lot of things to emphasize here. First, compare her clothing to that of the radiant woman we saw in chapter 12, who was clothed with the sun and with the stars and with the moon. This one is royal in that she's clothed with scarlet. Think about the scarlet robe they put on Jesus to signify, to mock his royalty before the crucifixion. So she's wearing royal adornment and beautiful things, but this obviously fails miserably compared to the radiant woman in chapter 12. And so just kind of keep working on that contrast, because we're going to continue to develop it as the book goes. So this is obviously a lot like some of the other harlots that we want to look at from Old Testament prophecy, but she is Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So emphasizing the widespread influence and the fact that all of these other things are proceeding from her, that she is the great influence. It doesn't necessarily mean that she invented all of these, but as ruling over the earth, she is responsible for what happens. Just as a father is responsible for what happens in his household, or a president over a country, there is something that this entity is responsible for. All right, so let's look at some of the other harlots. So very similar language is used for Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, and the thing that's emphasized is her conquest and her cruelty in the conquest. So in Nahum 3, he says, "Woe to the bloody city, it's full of lies and robbery, its victims never departs. You have the noises of whips and chariots and horses and swords, multitude of slain and a great number of bodies, countless corpses. They stumble over the corpses because of the multitude of harlotries of the seductive harlot, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations through her harlotries and families through her sorceries." Behold, I'm against you, says the Lord. And then he specifically says here at the end of verse 7, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? All right. So this city, this capital city of Assyria, is personified as a woman, as actually a very cruel and destructive woman, as a harlot in this case. So she has sold out these families and nations for her conquest. And so in this way, she was a harlot, prostituting herself and selling off others. All right. Babylon, very similar language. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate. So very clear reference to the fact that she hadn't been invaded, hadn't been violated, if you will, but that's going to come to an end. She's going to be taken as a city. Take the millstones and grind meal. Remove your veil. Take off the skirt. Uncover the thigh. Your nakedness shall be uncovered, O daughter of the Chaldeans. So she's going to be humiliated and put to slave labor. For you shall no longer be called the lady of kingdoms. I was angry with my people, giving them into your hand. You showed them no mercy. And in a moment, you're going to receive the loss of children, widowhood, because of your sorceries, for the great abundance of your enchantments. For you have trusted in your wickedness. Stand now with your enchantments and the multitude of your sorceries in which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps now you will be able to profit and prevail. So someone, I think this is a very interesting one because it talks about the Lady of Kingdoms. So it kind of reminds us of the mother of harlots. This is the one who's in a position over all the others, a broad influence again. All right. So Tyre, Caleb mentioned her as well, this harlot of commerce and wealth. And again, it's not the fact that she was an economic power. It's because of the fact that she was heavily involved in slave trade and then also became entirely materialistic. So the burden against Tyre, well, you ships of Tarshish, for his laid waste. So there's no house, no harbor. She is a marketplace for the nations. The sea basically gives her up and says, I do not labor. I do not bring forth children. And so Tyre is told to go sing the song of a harlot. Take a harp, go about the city, you forgotten harlot. Make sweet melody, sing many songs that you may be remembered. And it shall be at the end of 7 years that the Lord will visit Tyre. She will return to her hire and commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world on the face of the earth. Her gain and her pay will be set apart for the Lord. So Isaiah foretelling the double destruction of Tyre, being destroyed once, and at the end of 70 years, she is rebuilt and comes back into an economic powerhouse, and then she is destroyed again. So Tyre being given over to commerce and wealth. That'll become especially important as we look at chapter 18, which is entirely about commerce and wealth of Rome. All right, Jerusalem is also described as being a spiritual harlot, committing spiritual adultery through idolatry. So Isaiah sees Judah and Jerusalem, describes her as the daughter of Zion, being left as a booth in a vineyard, as a hut in a garden of cucumbers, a besieged city. How the faithful city has become a harlot. It was full of justice, righteousness lodged in it, but now murderers. All right, so describes the total corruption in the government. The princes are rebellious, companions of thieves, taking bribes, and allowing the fatherless and the widow to be taken advantage of. And again, in Jeremiah 2, 17 through 28, similar things are said again about Judah. Again, this time emphasizing her idolatry. It says, you have forsaken the Lord your God. You said, I will not transgress. When on every high hill and under every green tree, you have laid down playing the harlot, saying to a tree, you are my father, and to a stone, you gave birth to me. So obviously a reference to the terrible idolatry, turning to nature as being its creator. For according to the number of your cities are your gods, O Judah. All right, so think back to what we saw in chapter 13 with the beast. Remember how it had the parts of the lion, the parts of the leopard, the parts of the bear. It was a composite of all four of the nations that we saw from Daniel chapter 7. Babylon, the original ancient Babylon, as well as Medo-Persia, as well as Greece, and then finally Rome. There was a composite nature where it kind of took in all the characteristics of all of them. And in the same way, this harlot is doing the same kind of thing. All of the different kind of specialties, if you will, of harlotry that these other nations, Rome is kind of the ultimate form, the composite of all of them. So participating in all of the pieces, blasphemy, sorceries, being seductive, committing fornication with nations, we see it taken up even a notch with the persecution and the martyrdom that is also occurring. And then also her being the mother of harlots, that she is kind of the greatest of all of them, not just of those past, but the emphasis is on those at the time, the other nations and kingdoms around her that she's had this terrible influence on. All right, so as you can see, again, another very rich symbol with a lot of passages dealing with this. This is not something that's unique just to Rome. It's been applied to many nations before, and not just to Jerusalem either. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of people misunderstand this and think this is talking about Jerusalem is because they're not aware of the other passages that are applied to Nineveh, Babylon, and Tyre as well. So they assume this has to be Jerusalem because they think it's the only harlot that's mentioned in the Old Testament, and that's just not true. Other questions or thoughts, comments? All right. So why is John marveled? Why is he amazed? Why does he marvel at this harlot? What do you think? Yeah, yeah. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Again, this is when he says, when he's told, the angel says, I will show you the judgment. I want you to think sentencing. In a sentencing, why is judgment handed down? The judge always explains the judgment first. This is the reason why you are being sentenced. In this chapter, we see the reason for her sentencing, why she is being handed down her judgment. In the next chapter, we're going to see the beginning of that judgment being executed against her and what happens. So why is she being destroyed? Because she is reeling from delirious pleasure, from drunkenness, not over just pleasure, but actually at taking pleasure at the death of Christians. So think about the Colosseum, think about the Christians that were fed to lions and to other animals just for sport, just for the pleasure of the city to take in, just like a football game or a basketball game. What did they go see? What did they do on the weekend? Oh, we just watched a bunch of Christians get eaten by lions. So his amazement seems to focus on this woman, identifying her based off how the angel says, why are you amazed? I will tell you about her and her identification. So he seems to be thinking about, who is this? But the other piece of this that I think is also something we should be sympathetic to, if you try to put yourself in John's shoes and think about Christians that you knew that had already been killed up to this point and what was happening, think back to Elijah being stunned as he's standing before, I think it was Ben-Hadad, thinking about all of the people that he was going to kill, the children that he was going to dash their skulls in, and all of the atrocities that he was going to commit, and just standing there just kind of stunned and not able to speak to this person. I think you can see a similar kind of reaction here as you think about this, even though he doesn't know exactly who this is at this point, that all of the good people that is being killed and going to be killed by this entity. So amazing to think about it being so splendorous, so beautiful, and then yet so cruel and wicked and destructive at the same time. And also amazing that it hasn't been destroyed already. But that is the point of these chapters. This is why this destruction is coming. That's being explained to us. All right, any other thoughts about the harlot before we move into the beast? All right, so what is suggested by the description of the beast that was and is not and yet is? And I will say this is probably, I think, the hardest question for the entire quarter.
Could it be that the nature of it is that it rises and falls, but it's always still there somehow?
All right.
In some way.
So what part of it do you think is rising and falling?
The part that you see, like the kingdom, like the physical kingdom, maybe seems like it's being destroyed or that it's coming to power, but the nature of it is always there.
All right. So that definitely seems to play a part of it. So the angel says to John, why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was, and it is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. So I think that gives us a clue that this has to be something that is observable to other people. If we're talking about the rise and fall of empires, it's very hard for a person to see an empire rise and then fall and then come back. So this has to be something, I think, that could happen within a person's lifetime. It doesn't have to be, but I think it suggests that. So there's a couple of options here. We're going to talk about this more in just a minute. Actually, this is not the hardest question, I think. I think it's the next one. So the one idea could be is that the Roman Empire recovered from a near disaster. So either through incompetence of an emperor or an invasion or a civil war or whatever, almost is destroyed and it kind of comes back from the brink of disaster, but it's going to ultimately be destroyed. The other idea would be is that the persecuting influence. You would have, say, an emperor who is very oppressive, and then all of a sudden it goes away. That emperor goes away and the persecution goes away. Whew, that's over with. Nope. It's going to come back from the bottomless pit. So the bottomless pit we've seen already is associated with the origin of the devil. This is where he comes out of, where his influence comes out of. I shouldn't say origin. This is just where he comes out of. And so this shows that it's that kind of influence that's being applied to this. Again, going back to chapter 13, it was the dragon who gave the beast his throne and gave him his power. So I lean toward it being the persecuting influence coming and going, but it's hard to say for sure. All right, let's get into the next one. This is the one that I think is the hardest. How does the angel interpret the heads of the dragon? And how does this help us identify who the beast really is? We'll start with the easy part. What does the angel say about the heads?
There's seven mountains, which are seven kings.
All right. The heads represent seven mountains, and there are also seven kings. And assume that he's talking about the same thing. But he does say also there. So here's the mind, which has wisdom. I think that may be a clue. He's telling us we need to look at the end from the beginning. We're going to have to apply wisdom here. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. And the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition. All right, so as we try to understand this, a lot of people point to the fact that the city of Rome was built on seven hills. That's not seven mountains, but it is built on seven hills. So it's a little bit of a stretch. But a lot of people will latch onto that. But keep in mind, this is a figurative, symbolic book. Seven has very special meaning. So the fact that it was literally on seven hills, I would say, is kind of coincidental. All right. Now, the other thing is we have to distinguish between two types of kings. We're told the heads represent seven kings, but we're also told the horns represent kings as well. So there's some distinction that's made between these two levels of kings. So we're going to see, I think, that these horns have power just for a little time, and they're hoping to get some power. So I think those represent kings of like various nations, like think Herod and Pilate, what we call like petty kings, kings of provinces. They have power for a little bit. They've given their power over to the empire. They're being used as horns to drive the empire's war, but they are not in control. The heads are the one that are in control. So I think this suggests the Roman emperors. So most people who go this way kind of go off the rails at this point, trying to figure out, okay, if we take the heads literally, if we take them chronologically and start counting out the emperors, then we can pull in Nero, and who was the worst of the first bunch, and then we can work our way through just kind of waving our hands to Domitian being the eighth, who was the worst one to come. So that would kind of make a little bit of sense in saying that there's one that's still going to come, and he's going to be like one of the ones that came before. So Domitian is coming. He's going to be like Nero. He's going to be a terrible persecuting force. All right. So, and that's kind of the gist of all of these views, is that it's going to get worse before it's going to get better. We're not done yet. There has been persecution. You're going to get some respite, but there's going to be some more that's going to come. But ultimately, they're all going to be destroyed. All of these views fit within that umbrella, in that primary lesson. It's just the exact details of what they mean. That's the difficult part. So that doesn't work out so well, because if we're taking this chronologically, actually there was a whole lot more emperors to come after Domitian, and they were even worse in persecution than Domitian, who was worse than Nero. So it was going to get a lot worse, and they're not covered by these seven heads. So that makes it difficult. The other thing is it puts the time of writing in Vespasian, who's between Nero and Domitian, which doesn't fit with any of the evidence, and nobody on the early or the late date would agree with that. So I'm going to go back to the same thing that we keep saying over and over again. This is a book of symbols. You're not supposed to take it literally. So let's try to apply the same symbolic rules that we've developed up to this point. Keeping that in mind, seven. If we're associating this with the full work of God, the maximum power of God being applied, so they have full governing power, authority that is provided by God. So this is an empire with full rule, with full reign as provided by God. Now, we have that seven that's broken into five and two. Five has special meaning because five is a broken 10, all right? It represents a fraction of human power, of human capacity. So I think what we're being told is that what we're seeing represents some part of these emperors, some fraction of these emperors. Since we're talking about this persecuting influence, then that's what I would assume, then, that some fraction of the empire's emperors are going to be persecuting and be very destructive. It's interesting, the word fall is assumed by most people to mean that they died. And it can mean that, but also when we read about people falling down to worship somebody, it's the exact same word there as well. So could it be that these emperors have submitted, have fallen down, worshipped this persecuting influence. They've succumbed to this. So again, a mistake to try to interpret this chronologically, but maybe it's better to think of that from this other perspective, that they've succumbed or submitted. So if we take our seven that the angel has broken into five, and then he says it's two. Wait, no, it's really three. So if we think of the three, then that's our number for emphasis, for extremity. So a huge fraction, a significant portion of these emperors are going to be persecuting, and it's going to be a large number, and it's going to be very intense. All right, so that, taking with this was, is not, and not yet to come, I think all of this leads to the idea that, as I said earlier, it's going to get worse before it gets better. That they've already had some persecuting influence, but there's going to be more to come, and more emperors to come, and it's going to get worse. All right. That is actually what I lean towards it meaning. Is there any questions about this? I'm going to give you two other alternatives before we close this.
Could it be referring just to the judgment of this being assured?
Like that
its time is fulfilled?
Could be the certainty of its destruction. Yeah, could be a possibility. Let me, real quickly, as you're gathering your stuff up, let me give you the other two ideas. Another one, less popular, but that this represents the seven heads, or like kind of the seven, again, symbolic, but the kingdoms that make up the empire. That, but the problem is that's the whole point of the horns, these petty kings of the other provinces who have given their power over. And so I don't think that's a good option, because it's going to blur that distinction with the horns. The other way to look at this is again, trying to take this, going back to Daniel's use of kings representing kingdoms, could this represent the different empires that have led up to Rome, and Rome being the one that now is, and there's going to be another empire after Rome that comes in the same spirit? I think this is not a viable option, although it's very popular, because when we get to 1920, we're going to see the beast in its entirety chunked into the lake of fire before the 1,000 years. So that doesn't leave room for some empire to come along in chapter 20 that's supposedly a part of this beast, because it's already been burned up. So I don't think that one works either. I think you're going to have to go with some variation of what we looked at previously. Love to hear your comments and questions. We're going to pick up with the 10 horns next time. Thank you all.
Thank you.